Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Tiger Bales and Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all around the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. And welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening to our podcast or our website online, 989fm.com.au, welcome to you as well on this beautiful Thursday morning in Brisbane. And Tiger's not in again, so I'm flying solo again today, which is quite exciting. Our guest is currently on the line. We've got Melinda Hammond from Upunapima Cape York Health Council up in Cairns, and she's here to talk about food security in Cape York. Melinda, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
First of all, what is your position at the Health Council there?
I'm the nutrition team leader at Upunapima, so we're a health service that provides comprehensive primary health care to 11 communities across Cape York, so a really vast area. And part of our organisation is our nutrition team, so we've got three dietitians, a couple of community nutritionists, and myself as team leader.
And it's really interesting because food security is such a complex issue. When people talk about food security in Australia, I don't think they actually understand what it means. Is there a simple way to actually describe the current situation in Cape York regarding food security?
I often like to use the term food poverty to sum it up, actually. People connect with that more.
Yeah.
Because really, food insecurity is about not being able to access, you know, healthy food in a reasonable way to stay well nourished. And you see food insecurity a lot in developing countries, but it's tragic that we actually see this in our first world country. And the way, what actually happens is for a range of reasons, people go hungry. So there may be, it might be not just about the cost of food, because we do have very high cost of food in remote areas, but it might also be because people have underemployment and less income overall in the family unit. So if food is more expensive and you have less money to go around for living costs, and the cost of living in remote areas are very high, you've got this double, treble disadvantage happening. And we do see that in Cape York.
So we're not just talking about, because I remember a couple of years ago there was this big sort of scandal over starvation in the APY lands particularly, and the Red Cross were actually providing food drop. But in Cape York, we're not talking about starvation, are we, when you're talking about the nutrition deficiencies in these Cape York communities?
Well, I like to describe it as hidden hunger, because what we're seeing in Cape York is undernutrition, but it's coexisting with kind of overnutrition, apparently, on the surface. So we've got micronutrient malnutrition, and what I mean, that's a very technical term, but I'm talking about low iron, so kids with anemia, mums with anemia, and low red cell folate. And folate is critical in brain development in those early years and nervous system development. We actually have a problem with these low malnutrition that you would normally associate with skinny kids and, you know, starvation. But we've also, on the flip side of the coin, got overweight and obesity and a growing problem of overweight and obesity in children, and with that, a real concern around very early diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And type 2 diabetes you would normally see in adults. It's a, you know, diabetes that you develop from poor lifestyle behaviours. We're seeing this in very young children, and it was published in The Lancet, which is a highly regarded journal globally, and last year a team from the Diabetes Centre in Cairns published an article on a 5-year-old girl who was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. She was the child of a mum that had diabetes during pregnancy, and she also was a poorly controlled diabetic at the time. And when the child was diagnosed at 5 years of age, she was obese, so falling in that 95th percentile for her age. This is a real concern for the life of that child when we're getting kids that young. So it's a complex picture then. So we've got micronutrient deficiency coexisting with overweight and obesity and diabetes. So I call it hidden hunger. The link between the two is poor diet. So the diet of poverty, when you can't afford high quality nutritious food, you buy the food that fills your belly and satisfies kids in the family. And that is what we see.
Is there a lot of data to actually link a lot of those diseases to that diet of poverty and the cost of living, but also, you know, the quality of food and what people are actually choosing to eat, largely because of circumstance, I guess, in the remote communities?
There are some, a forum I was at in Sydney last week was a coming together of the experts in this research field of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nutrition. They have good evidence linking the biochemistry, the disease, with what people are actually consuming. So Professor Amanda Lee, Professor Karen O'Day, these people have been researching, and Dr. Julie Brimblecombe from Menzies in the Northern Territory, they have been researching these issues for many years. And what we know is that, consumption, the diet of poverty is linked to poor health outcomes.
Is it a matter of what's the first way to tackle this? Is it a matter of subsidies or trying to bring the cost of food and the quality of the cost of food down in these communities and the quality of food up? Is that the first step, or are there other sort of factors that have to come into play first?
Well, one of the issues that we face is, when I say hidden hunger, it's hidden on so many levels, but it's hidden, the actual issues are being buried because there's a lack of monitoring and reporting on this diet-related data. So what I mean by that is our teams and all health professionals operating in remote communities are collecting information on clients because we're treating people, we're treating the illness. But that data, there's no one in the health system who's collating that and reporting on it so that you can track and see the patterns over time. And because that's the way that health services and governments can plan where they invest. So I say it's hidden in that way because we're not reporting on it and monitoring it.
That's amazing, and, because when you think of Blackfellas being the most researched and studied people in the world, it just amazes me that something like this that seems, I mean, you say it's hidden, but it does seem obvious to me that if you obviously diet is related to a lot of the health, poor health in remote communities. Right. I mean, why has it taken so long, or why isn't it still not being done?
Well, it wasn't like this a decade ago. It was on the agenda, and that was one of the reasons why that forum took place in Sydney last week, was to really talk about, well, why is it that nutrition appears to be the gap in the closing the gap discussion in Australia? It seems to have fallen off the agenda. So we talk about closing the gap in life expectancy of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians compared to non-Indigenous Australians. But if diet-related disease is such a big part, how has it dropped off? And you know, there was a fabulous nutrition strategy called the National Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Nutrition Strategy and Action Plan. That's a mouthful. And that was developed back in 2000. It was a 10-year strategy. It had enormous amounts of community consultation and ownership and all really lots of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people involved. And there was a high level of commitment to it. And then it hardly got implemented. There wasn't the investment in implementing. So the issues that were identified back then were around social determinants of health, one of which is food insecurity. Another one was focusing on early life and tackling anemia. Another issue was healthy lifestyle of families, all of these, and another big part of it was workforce. You have to invest in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nutrition workforce so that people are talking about these issues and it is being discussed and there is good quality, skill sets out there. But that, it was very controversial.
Why was it controversial?
Well, what happened was the implementation of that strategy got evaluated. So there was a review report conducted in 2010 and it was never released.
Right.
And a researcher at Sydney Uni, Dr. Mark Locke, he asked for this paper. We wanted to see how well it was implemented and whether we got the outcomes that were hoped for. And he ended up having to do a Freedom of Information process to access the document. So he's now put it up on his website.
Wow.
And interestingly, it evaluated really well, but it was incredibly limited funding attached to it.
Right.
So really we're calling for, you need to have those, a national nutrition policy like that, with a big focus on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander populations because it's such a high burden of disease in that group. We need that because everything will fall out of that. That strong commitment will have everyone steering the ship in one direction and we might actually get traction on these issues.
Would we ever have a hope of closing the gap if we didn't actually start dealing with nutrition-related diseases?
Well, it's interesting. It fascinates me that in government reports we still see VOS reference used for burden of disease, which was back in 2007, whereas the global burden of disease study, 2010, has nutrition, diet as the single biggest contributor to the burden of disease.
Wow.
Beyond smoking. It has surpassed smoking.
Wow.
And yet, I don't know whether it's a convenience thing to choose the 2007 document that has it down the list, but it's really not getting traction.
I'm just wondering how this mantra, because it's sort of been the prevailing thinking in Aboriginal affairs from a government point of view for a very long time, and it actually sort of eventuated from the Cape, and it's around this sort of idea of personal responsibility. I wonder if that clouds the debate in any way, because I think of income management, and you mentioned Julie Brimcombe, who's actually done studies into income management in Northern Territory communities. I wonder how that conflicts with trying to tackle this problem of nutrition, this idea that you've got to take responsibility for your own life.
Well, it's really not helpful when leaders make comments like living in remote communities is a lifestyle choice. Those sort of comments are just seriously not helpful. And a focus on individual responsibility is important, but it's really only part of the picture. And so if people are experiencing low levels of employment and challenges with needing more support with education, there's broader social determinants of health that contribute to these issues. And I'm all for multi-strategy approaches to addressing nutrition issues. And what I mean by that kind of Govy speak is that you need to be doing some of the early detection and treatment. You need to be starting early and doing early intervention. You need to be offering people individual education around looking after themselves, group-based lifestyle programs, social marketing messages, getting the message out there, go for 2 and 5, that sort of thing. But there's also all of this other stuff around supportive environment. So actually influencing what's available in the stores and ways that the takeaways can be managed better in remote communities. These are what we call in health terms environmental support. So you reconfigure the where people live, work and play and reconfigure that so it's a healthy choice being the easy choice.
Yeah, right.
That's really important upstream kind of intervention. And the biggest upstream one we could go is around the fiscal policies in government and where taxes and subsidies could be explored if there was political will to do it. This is not new. The idea of targeted subsidies is a big investment of the United States government. They've had the Women's Infants and Children's Initiative, WIC, running for decades, where the most vulnerable members of the community, mums and kids and babies, have subsidised healthy food.
Yeah, right. So there's an international evidence that subsidies and things like this could actually work, is there?
Yes, there is. So the WIC program is for the cost effectiveness evaluates very well. One of the challenges with subsidies is to ensure that it's direct to consumer. And that's actually where we've got a little pilot feasibility study that Apuna Pima is doing in Cape York. We're doing it in partnership with Menzies and a really great store group we're working with, and also James Cook Uni. And it's a little pilot in one of our communities at the store where we're trying to, rather than it being a subsidy per se, we're rewarding shoppers for making healthy choices. So when people go in and they spend $15 on fruit and vegetables, we reward them with a voucher at the end of their shopper docket that allows them to go back in and buy another $10 worth of fruit and veg for free. So it's rewarding those healthy choices to shift people's shopping behaviours and consume more fruit and veggies.
I'm wondering.
So we're seeing that's just in one community at this stage and working through the logistics. But we really hope, if that looks promising, we could scale that up, do a multi-community trial, maybe across the Northern Territory, a whole top-end trial, to really see if this would work. So investing right there and rewarding the individual with a kind of subsidy, but in that co-contribution way, that might be more palatable to government than an outright handout. So
yeah,
watch this space.
I hope it goes well. And I was actually interested in, when you look at the Cape, you're talking about your health council covers 11 individual communities. I often find that communities are different from one to the other. Is there a situation where you have one community where they might actually be going really well in relation to nutrition, and then for some reason or another community is not, and you're able to differentiate why that is?
Well, there's different, I think, across the board. If you spoke to any community member or any health professional, Aboriginal or non-Indigenous, they would say that food insecurity is experienced across Cape York. So it's more or less degrees, and different issues going on in each place. I mean, for example, there's a very real running out of food issue that occurs every year in one of our communities, and I'll name that. It's Cowan.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up very soon. So
yeah, well, Cowan does run out of food. The shelves and the stores, they're independent operators.
During the wet season. So how many months is that for?
And that's a very much a geographic barrier there, because they run out of food because the trucks can't get through and it's not a sealed road. So, I mean, the response to that is, it's a no-brainer. Seal the road as soon as possible, and that won't happen. But for three to four months, every single year, those amazingly resilient people in Cowan cope without food.
And that's been going on for a very long time, isn't it, Melinda? Because I was actually researching Cowan a little bit, and I found an article from 2011 when they were talking about this. I mean, that's four years. Obviously, it's just it was going on a lot longer than that. But if we're talking about that situation 4 years ago.
It's getting sealed, but it's a little bit each year. And it's, I just find the resilience of those residents astounding. So
do you know what people do? Do they sort of keep food for those 4 months, or what happens? Does food get dropped into them, or?
If there is the Cookshire Council covers that area, and if there is a point at which the emergency team can call for a food drop. But that does happen. The strange thing is that they know they're going to run out of food every year.
Yeah.
It's just there's a critical point at which they call it and the police get involved and they do this emergency food drop. So it's not people are not going to starve, but it's that ongoing undernutrition, poor nutrient density, high energy filling rice, bread diet is not actually the best start in life for children.
When you talk about children, I mean, you're talking about early development earlier before, and I think all of Aboriginal, most Aboriginal people are working in where they're working because of trying to create a better environment for the next generation. How much is there a barrier put in front of our children just because of these food insecurity issues and the diet of poverty and this hidden hunger?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's incredibly concerning around the anemia issue. Yeah. So anemia is the end result of having low iron status or iron deficiency over a long period of time. The end result we see clinically is that the child is anemic. Why is that a problem? People often think, oh, anemia, that's just a little bit tired, a little bit listless. Not a big deal, is it? Well, actually, it's a really important issue because if that child has had been exposed to low iron status in pregnancy when they were still in utero, because we have a lot of mums that are low in iron as well because they're eating the same diet, then what happens is that child's brain development is compromised. So there's a direct link between anemia and brain development and neurological development. So that, in effect, is affecting children's learning capacity throughout life. That early start, they are precious, those first 1,000 days from conception through to when a child is around 2 to 3 years, critical period for brain development.
That's and really
so
scary.
We can invest a lot in school age, you know, schooling and education, but are we missing something? Should we be investing in that critical period of pregnancy and first 2 years of life, nutrition-wise, to really get a better outcome for education and opportunities for those children into the future?
And it feels, when we talk about nutrition, I mean, when you consider with all the other problems that are higher in remote communities and you look at, you know, obviously your high rates of alcohol abuse and tobacco use and everything, largely because of other issues, you know, it's there's other causal factors for that. How does that bump up with nutrition? Does it conflict in any way or does it further these diseases or complicate these diseases?
Well, you know, I think maybe nutritionists are a little bit at fault here where we have been talking to ourselves for too long, because that was something that was discussed at this forum last week in Sydney about the need to engage better with the other body parts, if you like the dentists and the people working in oral health. They have real interest in the importance of getting rid of soft drinks and looking after teeth, and a good diet is so critical in oral health. And I think if they champion these issues a bit more, they might get a bit more traction. Likewise, the hearing health people. Otitis media, which is when you've got a chronic infections in the ears that impair children's hearing and therefore their lifelong opportunities, then that has a direct link to nutritional status and poverty. So they could be champions for these nutrition issues too if we were communicating better with them. Also oral health is linked to chronic disease development, diabetes and cardiovascular disease in later life. So all these things are linked. I think that's why a national approach and a nutrition policy can help guide all the other people where nutrition influences, so they can be talking on these issues as well, so that doctors and nurses and all the other health professionals can be championing these issues as well.
Are we even close to getting that plan up? Because, I mean, like everything in Aboriginal affairs, it seems like an urgent problem now, and you talk about the children particularly. But as you said, governments in the past have actively sort of worked against it and even covered it up. So are we anywhere closer to that?
Well, the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan, which is current, very recent, that throughout the document it says, what are we going to do about food insecurity? That will be addressed in the National Nutrition Policy,
right.
Which, oh, it hasn't appeared.
And is that a mainstream one or an Aboriginal specific
that,
one?
That one's a mainstream one.
Okay.
And I mean, that needs to, if that does get some action, then it needs to have a very strong component or a separate matching document focused on our First Peoples, where nutrition is such a big issue.
I mean, there obviously are such key differences between mainstream and Aboriginal communities, but I guess even, I know you predominantly work around Cape York, but is it a similar case, for example, in Cairns or other parts of regional or urban Australia for Aboriginal people where we may have, because you're talking about food choices or you know, food insecurity where you're not actually eating the right things. Is that similar issues raised in regional and urban Australia for our people?
Food insecurity is certainly an issue among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people living in regional and urban areas as well. It's, I guess it's more pronounced and more dramatic in remote areas, but certainly the Australian Bureau of Statistics released data in March this year on food insecurity, and there was, it was, it's five times higher among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians than non-Indigenous Australians.
Yeah.
And the rates of food insecurity in remote areas are 30%,
yeah,
31%,
right.
I think it was. But and I think that's an underreport for Cape York, actually, based on what we see day to day as practitioners.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, but having said that, these foods, the type of foods that people are consuming these days. Has changed, and we have an issue across the board, whether you're Aboriginal or non-Indigenous. It's National Nutrition Week next week, so it's interesting having this conversation with you now. And the campaign this year is Pick Right, Feel Bright, I think, and it's about promoting for everyone to eat more vegetables and try for five, because 95% of Australians don't eat the recommended amount of vegetables. And only, you know, the average Australian eats less than half of what they should.
Yeah.
But
I wouldn't be surprised
what
if
we
that's
are
statistic.
Eating, around a third of what we're eating is what we call, the junk foods. So
yeah.
Takeaway foods, cakes, sweets, sugary drinks, confectionery, things that you totally do not need. So a third of what Australians eat. So I think what we see in remote communities is kind of a reflection of what's going on everywhere else, except we've got this double, triple disadvantage of food insecurity more pronounced, so it makes it worse.
Just quickly before we go, because we don't have a lot of time, I think we only got about a minute, but can part of the problem be solved or actually helped in going back to country and traditional food sources? Is that a legitimate sort of solution or achievable?
Well, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians lived a very well-nourished, healthy, happy life for 40,000 years before colonisation in Australia. And the foods that people did eat, traditional foods, were incredibly nutritious, very nutrient-dense, lovely and high in iron and all those micronutrients, and they were low in energy, so that wasn't that overweight obesity issue.
Yeah.
So I think any traditional foods people can access, then that's definitely something to encourage, and we certainly have that in all of our messages in the work we do in Cape York.
Thanks for your time today, Melinda. We actually have to leave it there, but I really appreciate it, and hopefully we can keep talking about it in the future, and good luck at the Health Council with your campaign. So
thank you very much, Amy.
Thanks for that. That was Melinda Hammond from Apunipima Health Council up in Cape York. That's all we have for today. We'll be back tomorrow. Have a good day.
98.9 FM News.
Across Australia, this is Adam Evans with the National Indigenous News. The Queensland Government is set to fork out almost $250,000 in compensation to two Palm Island residents after the Court of Appeal determined the couple to be victims of abuse of power during civil unrest on the island in 2004. In a scathing ruling by the full bench, the court determined the violent raid on the home of David John Bulsey and his pregnant partner, Yvette Faith Lanois, had been a grievous wrong. The ruling describes in disturbing detail the humiliating and distressing police raid on the home of the couple and their six children on the 27th of November 2004. The court appeal found the couple should be awarded with significant damages and ordered the state government to pay Mr. Bolsey $165,000 and Ms. Lanois $70,000. The decision overruled a previous finding by Townsville-based judge David North. Judge Hugh Fraser remarked that Ms. Lanois became a frightened and shocked prisoner in her own home, while Judge Duncan McMeekin said the raids were not justified by law and were not merely a technical breach. The landmark findings marked the first compensation payment awarded to victims of the police response into the Palm Island unrest and come as the federal court considers a separate class action for compensation on behalf of all residents on the island. New research commissioned by the Cancer Council Australia has revealed 1 in 3 Australians can avoid cancer each year by introducing simple changes to their lifestyle. The study shows around 37,000 cases a year can potentially be prevented. According to a 2013 study by the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, the most commonly diagnosed forms of cancer for Indigenous people are lung, bowel and breast cancer. Indigenous people are also more likely to be diagnosed at a younger age. Professor David Whiteman from QMI Arbogofa Medical Research Institute led the research and says it's important for people to recognise the common causes of cancer and how small changes can ultimately lead to a healthier lifestyle.
We found that about 1 in 3 cancers that occur in Australia, so 37,000 Australians each year, are diagnosed with a cancer that is potentially preventable. And the factors that we found causing the most cancers in the community were tobacco, overexposure to sunlight, poor diet, obesity and overweight, and infections. It's important to collect exposure information about risk factors on cancer and estimating how much cancer is caused by these things, because it helps us define just how many cancers could be prevented. It gives us opportunities for directing our resources to cancer prevention. And it also highlights that some cancers that are common, such as prostate cancer and thyroid cancer, we don't yet have modifiable causes that we can target for prevention. Local residents can take from this the importance of modifiable factors in reducing their risk of cancer. So such things as quitting smoking entirely, cutting down on alcohol consumption, exercising regularly, and eating a rich, balanced diet that is rich in fruit and vegetables, high in fibre, and moderates the amount of red meat that people consume.
Sport and weather after the break.
Hi, I'm Nathan Merritt, former Rabbitohs player. Have you thought about expanding your business to include services to support Aboriginal people with disability and their families? In 2016, the National Disability Insurance Scheme will roll out across New South Wales. This is an exciting opportunity for Aboriginal community-controlled organisations to be part of the rollout. ABSSEC has been funded by the New South Wales Government to build capacity of an Aboriginal disability sector to provide supports to our community. If your organisation would like to be part of this, contact ABSSEC on 02 95 5999.
Program sponsor.
Sport now with Sean Benley.
Wallaby fullback Israel Folau is in doubt for Sunday's final pool game against Wales at the Rugby World Cup. Folau left the field in the second half of the win over England with what was believed to be ankle ligament damage and is yet to train with the side this week. Wales will go into the quarterfinals with Australia regardless of Sunday's result, and Wales attack coach Rob Howley says whether Folau plays or not, the Welsh will be concentrating on playing their own game and not letting their tactics be dictated by the makeup of the Wallaby side that will also be without the suspended Michael Hooper.
I spoke before the England game really, and what we've done over the last 16 weeks is to focus on ourselves in terms of selection and our training, and we'll do exactly the same. This week is no different to us.
And that's the latest in news and sport.
You can't go past 98.9 FM for the best country. And it's another hour of it right here on 98.9 FM.
Dancing down in Hollywood, celebrating like a good man should. 'Cause I spend my days down in New Orleans. I told you that I knew we would head on back out to California, spend your time making all new friends. And I'll spend my nights under neon lights. I told you it's the best thing for us. Hit the highway out to Mississippi, cross over into Tennessee.
where I walk the streets, listen to the king. I told you it's a sight to see. For once I'm home with you in my arms, like I told you that I knew we would.
But the land is burning now. wrong you made. Take the poison, be it quick. Let it be you.
To my eyes, sleeping in a concrete box, holes in my shoes.